Okay. So let us start the questions again for this evening. There was one question left over from last night that I promised to get back to. And this was the one about the types of personality a noble one has. This was from the Majjhima Nikaya in the Asevitabha Sutta. Writes about good and bad acquisition of individuality. Is this referring to acquisition of a positive personality for practice? I think what this is about is it is actually about rebirth. This is called Atta Bhava Patilabha in Pali, and it usually is a reference to rebirth. And there are certain rebirths that are more, or actually are conducive to practice, and other rebirths that are not conducive. And basically, it's fairly straightforward. The kind of rebirth you don't want is to be reborn in the lower realm. But if you get reborn in a kind of a human realm, or perhaps in a higher realm than a human realm, it basically you are okay, because that is what the Dhamma is taught. But if you get reborn in a lower realm, that's when you have a problem, because there is no practice of the Dhamma. Ghosts don't practice Dhamma. Do ghosts practice Dhamma? I wonder. Maybe they meditate as well. I'm not sure. Ghost meditation, that would be very interesting. I don't think so. I think ghosts, if you get reborn in a ghost realm, not recommended. So try to avoid that one. Animals also have a hard time practicing, as we can see with the way things are in the animal world. So that is really what that is about. Okay. Let's go on to the next one, sir. Ajahn, can you please talk more about the four right efforts, especially the first two? You want to talk more about the first two of the four right efforts? Okay. I think the idea about the two right efforts is really the ones about overcoming the unwholesome qualities. And this is a very important area for practice because it takes a lot of takes quite a lot of skill and reflection to overcome the desires in the world, and also the ill will, and especially the ill will is very important to overcome. So because of that, I'm actually going to give a whole talk on that later on. It is one of my favorite suttas that I always give on every meditation retreat. So I hope all of you, I hope you are okay with that, because some of you have heard this sutta many times, but you're going to hear it again, because I enjoy it almost every time I read it out. And then there's the other one about how to overcome desires and how to overcome the attachments to the worldly things. That's another really nice sutta, which has all these beautiful similes about the problems with the sensual objects and sensual desires. There's going to be two full sessions on how, on more detailed on these four right efforts. But I'm going to wait till we come to the bhujangas to talk about that, because in connection with the bhujangas, which are the factors of awakening here, I'm also going to talk about the five hindrances, because the five hindrances and the bhujangas, they usually go together as a pair. The five hindrances and the bhujangas are opposed to each other. So as you reduce the hindrances, the bhujangas start to arise. And if you're able to access the bhujangas, the hindrances go down. So these are very closely related to each other. So it's kind of useful to talk about then. So that's why I'm going to leave it out until later on during this retreat. So I hope you're okay with that. But again, just to give you maybe I should say something in case you want to use this during this retreat. Again, the main idea behind the overcoming ill will and aversion towards other people is to focus on the good qualities in the people around you. That's a very important aspect. And when you are on a retreat like this, it is incredibly useful to remember that everyone who comes here, everyone here is a really good person. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. What's the point of being here if you are a scallywag? So no one here is going to be a scallywag. It's almost guaranteed by the very fact of everyone's presence here that they are good people. So just remind yourself of that. During daily life, maybe little irritations may arise because people always do things that are contrary to what we expect them to do. Because we are different, that's kind of to be expected. But remember, that's kind of irrelevant. That's nothing compared to the good qualities of people who come to a place like this. And if you remember that, you won't be able to get upset at all during these 9-day retreats. So if you do get upset, you overcome it very quickly by reminding yourself of that little perception that actually these are people with very positive and very good intentions. And what a wonderful blessing it is for each one of us to be part of a group such as this. So that is how, that is a very, at least now during this retreat, it's a very easy way of overcoming ill will and anger. Then I'm going to read out the sutta, which talks about it more broadly, more generally, in everyday life and everything else, how to deal with those things. That's just to give you a little bit of things to chew on until we get to that sutta later on. Okay. So, what do you think as the reason for the Buddha for not including brain in the 31 parts of the body? What is the reason? The reason might be that the brain was considered part of one of the other organs, and I think that is the standard explanation that it is given, that it is kind of, I think it was considered part of bone marrow, I think, because bone marrow, Atiminja is considered one of the 31 parts, and the brain was kind of considered an extension of that because it was maybe inside the skull, so it was kind of considered part of bone marrow. So that might be the reason why it was not included. Or perhaps the brain wasn't considered so important. It's a nice thought, isn't it? Because we tend to see the brain as so incredibly important in a modern world. But maybe the brain is actually just a hassle. As the brain is where all the thinking and all the stupidity goes on very often. So maybe checking out the brain is a good idea. I don't know. And it's very often when we talk about the mind in Buddhism, the Pali word that we use for mind is citta. And some people prefer to translate it as heart, because mind is also a place for emotions. And emotions are in many ways more important than the thinking aspects of things, because we are driven by emotions as human beings. We're driven by our likes and dislikes of pleasant and unpleasant feelings. These things are far more important usually than the kind of rational faculty. The rational faculty is usually there, is usually in service of our emotions. Our emotions comes first, and then we justify things afterwards using our so-called rational faculty. At least sometimes. Yeah, sometimes it's, of course, it's useful as well to think rationally, but very often it is not as rational as perhaps we would like. Anyway, so that is a short explanation for you. Thank you, Ajahn, for explaining how to use wisdom to get rid of desire. Can you elaborate on how to do the same for aversion? How do we deal with things like fear of heights, bugs, etc., or not liking things like our work, our job? Okay, so if you have fears of things, or there are things you don't like, there are a number of ways of dealing with this. The fear of things, for example, of heights and bugs. Sometimes these fears, they are kind of conditioned into us from past lives. They go back into the past or something. And sometimes it may not be such a big deal. Even if you have fear of heights, what's the big problem? How often do you stand on a cliff anyway? It's not that often, yeah? I must admit, I don't really like heights myself all that much. But, you know, it's very rare that it is a problem for me, so I don't really kind of worry so much about that. Fear of bugs might perhaps be more problematic if it is something you have to deal with every day, but if it's not, then don't worry about it. But sometimes these days they use kind of exposure therapy to bugs. You actually learn how to deal with it by being exposed to it. So maybe you should just slowly allow yourself to be exposed to these things. And then eventually, when you realize, actually, it's not really dangerous at all, then it's not really a problem anymore. So that might actually be the best way. Sometimes you just have to kind of face your fears. And by facing them, you actually overcome them. Like fear of flying, sometimes it is just by flying itself that you actually overcome the fear of flying. So that is one way, and of course you can also try to tell yourself that your fear is irrational. I very often, of course, that doesn't overcome the fears, but if you think about ways, if you think about the bugs in a new way, think about the bugs as little beings with little desires, they also want to have a happy life, think about them in a new way, think about them as almost like little human beings crawling around on the ground, being terrified of us. Imagine how terrifying it is to be a tiny little bug, just waiting like a cockroach, waiting to be slapped with a shoe by some human being who doesn't like you because they think you are bad and evil or whatever. It's terrible. Yeah, that's why they run so fast whenever they see a human being. They crawl into a corner or whatever because they are really terrified. So try to see the world a little bit from the cockroach's point of view. So then if you get reborn as a cockroach, you are ready, yeah, because you know what it's like. No, I'm being naughty now. So, but by doing that, you kind of put yourself in the position and you understand the fears of the other creature. And then they start to become less terrifying. It's like people being afraid of ghosts. And in some cultures, and I know in Thailand, for example, it is very common to hear ghost stories. And you hear the ghost stories from the moment you are born, you start to hear the first ghost stories. And of course, by the time you are kind of a teenager, you are absolutely terrified of ghosts. And so many people in a culture like that, they are terrified because of all the stories they have heard. So you have been conditioned into you. So what you have to do is you have to change your perception of ghosts. Ghosts are beings just like us. They are terrified, they are fearful, they're trying to find happiness in the world. They don't really want to do anything bad to anybody. And so ghosts are not really frightening. Human beings are probably far more frightening than ghosts because we have more power. Ghosts don't have much power. They're kind of just wandering around in the ghost realm, suffering, etc. So it's all about the perceptions that we have. And by changing the perceptions, you can also change your outlook and you can overcome some of these phobias that we have. At our kutis in the forest at Bodhinana Monastery, we have lots of really sometimes scary insects, like all these redbacks crawling around. And sometimes the redbacks, they're quite poisonous spiders, in case you are not from Australia. Poisonous spiders, and they're not really, you don't really want to touch them or have them too close, but after a while you learn even to live with the redbacks. You let them be, and when you let them be, they don't really bother you. But if you try to bother them, then of course they might get a bit agitated, and they might sting you or bite you, whatever it is that they do. So it's possible to live in peace with these things. And I know sometimes people who come from the city, they come to the forest here in Serpentine, especially if you come from cities that are kind of really large and far away, and you come here and you are afraid of all the snakes, because Australia has a reputation for having so many bad snakes. Actually, it's not dangerous at all. You hardly ever see any snakes around here. And if you happen to see one, you're so happy, because they're quite, you know, beautiful to see a snake. So you say hello to the snake, and the snake runs off or slithers off anyway, because they are more afraid of you. So sometimes the fear is far worse than the reality. The reality is not usually a problem at all. Anyway, I'm getting carried away as usual. So just try to kind of deal with these things through some of these methods, thinking differently, and through exposure therapy. There might be many psychological tricks you can use. Just Google fear of bugs on the internet and see what happens. And see if you get something nice. Not liking things like your work and job. I don't know, get a new job maybe. Maybe that's one way of doing it. The problem is sometimes you get a new job and it's exactly the same. Yeah, it doesn't really change things all that much. Have more compassion for the people around you. Understand that everyone is in this mess together. Everyone suffers more than they like. Nobody has really got too much happiness in this world. Your colleagues are probably stressed out just like you are, and they try their best, but they have a hard time. Maybe you have a very difficult boss, but usually there's a reason why bosses are difficult too, because they also are under stress and under pressure, and they also have to deliver according to the bottom line. We live in a world that is obsessed with the wrong kind of goals that are not really spiritual. And because the world is obsessed by that, we can expect the world to actually create a lot of suffering. It's kind of crazy. We want the economy to grow. We want to work hard so the economy grows, because when the economy grows, we're supposed to be happy. And then in the meantime, we create all this suffering. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? We don't actually create anything positive. We may be economically well off, but then psychologically, we're kind of in a mess. what's the point? It's nuts. The real happiness happens inside. It's in the mind that happiness really works. It doesn't really help you to be a psychological wreck, and being happy materially doesn't work. Silly. So just try to have more compassion for people around you. Have compassion for yourself. Understand that the world is an often difficult place for everyone. And this is a very useful understanding, because the more you see things not as a specific problem but as a universal problem, makes you more interested in the spiritual path. If you think that problems are there and that they can be solved, then you are always going to run around try to solve problems. But when you understand that things are actually universal, suffering is universal, suffering is not something that you can always solve, eventually comes the realization that there's only one way out, and that is practice in the spiritual path. And the rest, you're just going to have to accept. You're going to have to accept a fair amount of dukkha, because suffering is basically part of the human predicament. So sometimes people who try to solve all the world's problems, yes, we try to solve, but you also realize at the same time that actually it will never all be solved. It's impossible. The dukkha, suffering, is always going to be there. And that is one of the things that drives you onto the spiritual path and the spiritual practice. So this is an important point to remember when you go to work and you think it's difficult. Remember, this is the way, probably the way it has to be in many ways. Okay. Today my breath became really subtle and pleasant, but with that I think I became too excited and curious. What do I do? That's wonderful, that's really great when the breath becomes subtle and pleasant. That's great. So you are doing well. Yeah, this is kind of what we should expect when the breath meditation really starts to work. And there's a number of people on this retreat who are already getting nice meditation, and what a wonderful thing that is. But remember, it's still fairly superficial. There's no big deal if your breath gets a bit subtle and pleasant. There's nothing to get excited about. Yeah, it's only the beginning of a long path into more and more subtle breaths, more and more pleasant feelings, a long way down the track. Yeah. So just relax and just enjoy it. Yeah, this is the natural outcome of what you're doing. Nothing really big has happened yet. If you were a stream enter, then you could really come and you could really say, wow, I got so. And then you wouldn't get excited, because then you would have a very different view of things anyway. So it's okay to have pleasant feelings. It's fine. Nothing to get excited about, because you have a long way to go. After a while, you just do these things again and again. You get used to them. They are just natural. You understand that excitement is completely counterproductive. You just enjoy what is there. You understand these things arise because of cause and conditions. It's no big deal anymore. This is a kind of a counteraction for the excitement and the things that destroy the meditation. Something like that. Okay, how do you overcome sleepiness when meditating here? One thing you can do is sleep, yeah? If you are very sleepy, go back to your room and just chill, lie down on your bed and just whatever. And then after lying down for a while, have a really strong cup of tea, or a cup of coffee, even better, really powerful cup of coffee. So sleeping and coffee together is a really good combination. Then you come back here, yeah, and you're buzzing with energy. Then your mind is going to think. And then the next question is going to be, I'm thinking too much. How can I stop my thinking? That's going to be the next question. The mind is a bit like that. It's like a yo-yo, going from thinking to tiredness, ding, ding, ding. You can't really find that middle there somewhere. And occasionally, when you finally find the middle, then what happens? You get excited, like this one here. So it's hard, it's difficult, yeah. The sleepiness, there are many reasons why there is sleepiness. One of them is, again, as I said, just sleep a little bit extra. It's still early days on the retreat. It's still only the second day. So just don't be afraid of sleeping a bit extra. That doesn't necessarily mean you will overcome the sleepiness, but at least you will have tried your very best. So the main reason why you get sleepy when you have slept enough is because the first two hindrances are still quite active. Sensual, too much desire in the sensual realm makes us sleepy because the mind is always running around, craving for things, demanding things. And then when you can't get those things, yeah, you're on retreat, you haven't got any stimulation of the normal types, there's no access to computers and the internet, there's no entertainment, there's none of the ordinary stuff that we kind of lean on in life to have a kind of to enjoy life, then the mind sort of just shuts down. The mind doesn't want to be alive anymore. It just wants to shut down, blot everything out because it's just misery. Jhana grow is terrible. Oh, no internet, no, whoa, what am I going to do? Yeah, it's just really bad. I can just lie on my bed all day. Yeah. But I'm sure you don't see it like that. I'm sure you understand also that there's something very good going on here. I'm just kind of exaggerating a bit for effect as usual. So so remember that is where the problem very often is. So by remembering the dangers in that sensual world, remember that fact that it's not really going to be satisfactory, try to get a bit of distance to all of that. Yeah, it is never really going to do anything for you in this life. And eventually when you die, everything has to go. And what you take with you are the spiritual qualities that you have built up during your life, including on this very retreat. This retreat is a great opportunity to listen to the spiritual teachings, to build up your spiritual qualities, to understand more about the Buddhist path. And as you do that, you will take that with you in your life, and then as allow these things to grow until the day comes when you have to pass away from this life. So remember, this is one of the main problems. Another main problem why you are sleepy is because of the second hindrance, ill will. So try. If you have any ill will and it grudges against people or whatever, this is the opportunity to overcome that. Yeah, have a bit more metta. Remember the great fortune of being around a group of people like this who are all heading in the right direction, other people who want the best for you and they want to support you and all the right things. What a wonderful thing that is. Have metta for all the people who are here. Have metta for the people that you have left behind, maybe, I don't know who it is that you, if you have any ill will towards somebody, whoever it is, give them a bit of metta, because now you have more distance to the people who are far away. So if by dealing with the two first hindrances, very often you're dealing with sleepiness as well, because these are the things that cause a tired mind. Anger, ill will, always leads to tiredness at the end of the day. You have, sometimes you have these activists who run on anger. They're fueled by anger, yeah? Righteous anger, because the world is unfair. And what happens to this activist is that, yes, they get a bit of energy out of the anger. That's what they say. But later on, you get tired. And in the meantime, your perception of what is going on is distorted because of the anger. And then you do silly things as an activist. You become violent and all these kind of things as a consequence. And then it's really terrible. Then it's better not to be an activist at all and just to chill at Dharma Grove instead. So these are the ways to overcome that. And again, because it might be that you are missing some of the comforts of ordinary life, you have to really find that joy in the spiritual path. Find out why this matters, why it is nice just to sit down and close your eyes and be peaceful inside, why that is a far superior happiness to anything you can find in the world, and take that deeper. The more you understand that, the more your mind is going to brighten up, because the mind wants to be present. The mind wants to be present because it's finding happiness in the present moment. The present moment becomes the pleasant moment. That is one of those catchphrases by Ajahn Brahm: make the present moment a pleasant moment. And then you are in business. So see if any of that works. Okay. You are always welcome to ask the same questions again if you feel that I haven't answered it properly. So please just come back to these things. How can Dhamma help overcome unpleasant states to do with old entrenched attachments that are based in the world, the five senses, particularly when they seem to color many aspects of life and therefore practice? So the way to overcome things that have to do entrenched attachments and unpleasant states that are are kind of based on that is first of all, you overcome attachments just by practicing the Dhamma and finding happiness somewhere else, finding happiness on the spiritual path. These attachments tend to fade away because attachments, what we attach to in this world depends on where we find happiness. If you find happiness in the spiritual path, all the other attachments seem to be less important, and you start to let them go. They don't matter so much anymore, and for that reason, attachments generally start to fade away as you practice Dhamma. Or rather, I should say, you start to get new attachments. Yeah, you get a bit of attachment to meditation maybe, a bit of attachment to being kind. These are good attachments. They are good, first of all, because they are weaker attachments than attachments you have in the world. They're not as strong. They're not as kind of as dangerous. And also, they are attachments that lead to the end of attachment. Certain attachments are good. All attachments are bad. Attach where it is good, and then you will be on the right path. But the Dhamma helps in many other ways as well. I don't know exactly what your problem is here, but basically just by overcoming ill will, by finding happiness and joy inside of yourself, by all of these things together, they tend to overcome these attachments gradually, because you start to understand people in a different way, you start to understand yourself in a different way, and you find the joy in life in a different place. So these things gradually start to fade away and become less of a problem. You probably have to be a bit more specific if I'm going to answer the question more properly, but that's kind of a general answer for you. So, good luck with your attachments. Okay, I overslept and missed the morning talk on effort. How should I put in the right effort, Ajahn? Oh, that is right. That's what happens when you when the effort is not there. You lose out on the talk on effort. That's a bit unfortunate, isn't it? So kind of it shows you how the problem is. The right effort is just, you know, as I said before, you don't have to come for the talks. The fact that you overslept, I congratulate you, because it means that you don't take the talks too seriously, and you're just chilling out in your room, and that actually is quite a nice thing to be able to do that. The talks are all the same, all the same all the time, same old stuff that you hear again and again and again. You don't have to worry about it if you miss a talk. And it's nice to rehear the talks because it reminds you of what needs to be done on the path. It's nice for me to give the talk because it reminds me of what I have to do as well, which is kind of nice. So it's always good. But it doesn't, also at the same time, it doesn't matter. It is largely the same instructions that you've heard before. So just get out an old talk on effort, and it might be verbatim exactly the same as the talk was now. And this is one of the things that Ajahn Brahm told the story a long time ago. He told the story of he gave a talk at the Amaloka Center many years ago, maybe 30 years ago or something. And after having given this talk at the Amaloka Center, he decided for some reason to listen to another talk that he had given a few years before. And when he listened to this other talk, he was kind of shocked. He was shocked because the talk that he had given a few years before was almost exactly the same as the talk that he gave that he had just given that evening or that day before or whatever. Yeah, so it's not a joke that when we give these talks, basically very often they are exactly the same. And the reason why they may not sound exactly the same is because in the meantime you have changed. In the meantime, you look at the world differently, so the talk sounds different. It's just like reading the sutta. As you read them one year, you read the sutta in one way, and the next year you wonder, did I read a sutta before? Wow, this looks so different this time around. And that is because you have changed, and because because you have read more suttas, you're looking at the suttas in a different way. Sometimes it is not, it doesn't matter all that much. But for Ajahn Brahm, it was very interesting because he said that for him, that gave rise to a big insight into non-self. Because when you realize how conditioned we are, you think that you are doing something from scratch, you think it is this is my talk, and I am making a conscious decision to speak in this particular way. And it turns out you're just rerunning the same program you ran 3 or 4 years before. Then you get some insight into the idea of non-self. It's like a robot. Well, have a robot up here. There's no point in having, it looks like Ajahn Brahm. Is that going to work? That probably works. That probably work really well. And then you just replay the talks. But that's what's happening anyway. So it's not really an issue here. So good. So that's good. You probably are doing the right effort already by sleeping in. So don't worry too much about it. Are you here now? By the way, maybe you're still sleeping. I don't know. I forgot to check that. Otherwise, you won't get this answer. Anyway. Good. So let's go on to the next one. Ajahn, there are contemporary teachers such as Eckhart Tolle and Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, whom are thought to be enlightened. What sort of mental state would you think the enlightenment is? Because to Buddhism, a fully enlightened person would need to be ordained as a monk to remain alive. Thank you. Yes, there are lots of people who are thought by some to be enlightened, not by everyone, mind you, but by some. And there are some who think that they are enlightened, who have a website and says, Arahant, I am the Arahant so-and-so on their website, if you go to the website. And then in the evening they go to work, in the day they go to work, and in the evening they come back to their wife at home. And then the rest, and all the time they are supposed to be Arahants. So you have to take these Arahants with a big pinch of salt, with a big kind of scoop of salt, actually. So a lot of these people who claim to be Arahants, remember that being an Arahant is a very profound thing. Teachers such as Eckhart Tolle, the chances that he is an Arahant, in my opinion, is zero, basically, to be honest with you. He had some kind of profound experience, but to actually be able to say whether that has anything to do with Arahantship is a completely different matter. Because experiences are very profound, depending on where you come from. He, as far as I know, he was very depressed for a long time. And then suddenly he had this, I haven't read any of his books, that's what I've just have heard. He was very depressed, and then suddenly he had this kind of amazing experience. And then after that, he kind of, I don't know if he calls himself, and I have no idea whatever he called, but he had this amazing experience. And of course, if you are very depressed, you're very down, and then one day maybe you get into a state of samadhi or something, you can imagine the difference. It's a massive difference from being really, really low to being very, very high all of a sudden. And of course, it's very easy to think because of that, that you have become enlightened because of the massive difference in the state you had before and the state you have after. And this is how often sometimes you get these misunderstandings of awakening. It's simply because somebody has some massive shift in the consciousness. It does not mean they are awakened. It just means that they had a shift. That's all it really means. Also, it is often very hard to distinguish between really deep samadhi and awakening, because really deep samadhi you have left behind is a very similar state to the states of awakening, because in deep samadhi you have no hindrances. So the mind is almost completely pure. In deep samadhi there's very little sense of self left. The only sense of self that is left is the identification with your consciousness and your awareness. So very little sense of self left. There is a sense of being unified with the whole universe. There's kind of all boundaries are gone. You get this feeling, wow, this is just really amazing. All boundaries, everything is gone. And the feeling of everything being unified in a very profound sense. And this is why sometimes people who have these experiences, if they come from a Hindu tradition or a Christian tradition, they call it unification with God, because that's what it feels like. If you have some preconceived idea of what God is, then surely it must be like this. It's happy, it's unified, there's no ego. Surely this must be what God is like. So they interpret in that way, because they come from a certain doctrine that colors the views they have of these experiences. We have to be very careful, and very often, in my experience, people who call themselves awakened or enlightened, they are people who have precisely these kind of experiences. They have some kind of samadhi experience that they overestimate, and then they say, I'm awakened. And it's very natural to think that, because these things are extraordinarily profound, especially when you get into the jhanas proper. They are life-changing things when these things happen. When you hear people getting into jhanas quickly and easily on retreats, be very skeptical, because these are very life-changing experiences. And if it's too easy, it is too good to be true, quite literally. So this is my take on this. This is what I think Eckhart Tolle, he had some kind of, probably some kind of samadhi experience. Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, he had a book called I Am That. And I Am That is a wrong view, according to the suttas. It's literally stated directly, Eso Ahang Asmi, which means I Am That, is stated to be a wrong view, a papancha, a manyita in the suttas by the Buddha. So if the title of his book is wrong view, you can assume that he is not enlightened. Yeah. So this is just this may seem harsh, but that is kind of that's the way I take that. And so you read the book in that light, and I think you have to because that is kind of the main teaching that he had. I Am That, and it is problematic. He comes from a Hindu tradition, a Brahmanical tradition, and that tradition is about finding Brahma, unification with Brahma. You should not expect that awakening to be the same as the Buddhist awakening, when the Buddha specifically repudiates the whole idea of a Brahma, of a creator God, a God that is always there, and the self, and all of these ideas of a permanent identity inside of us. Actually, this also happens in Buddhism itself quite often. If you look at the Buddhist world, it's quite common for these days for people to claim awakening. And very often, if you look at it carefully, it seems to be samadhi states they're talking about. Because they're talking about eternal minds and all these kind of things. And that is really what samadhi is about. So, there you are. So that is my take on that. So, see what you want to make of it. Let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, please explain the difference between Satipatthana versus Anapanasati Sutta. Thank you. I'm going to talk about the Anapanasati Sutta tomorrow, probably. The difference is just that Satipatthana is more broad. Satipatthana includes more things, more ways, more exercises, and more ways of dealing with the mind, whereas Anapanasati is a very particular meditation topic. So you could say that Anapanasati is one way of doing Satipatthana, but Satipatthana is broader than Anapanasati. Anapanasati fits into Satipatthana, but Satipatthana is more than Anapanasati. That's the relationship. But it is, according to the Anapanasati Sutta, it is sufficient to do Anapanasati. If that works for you, Anapanasati works for you, and it is something that you enjoy, the mindfulness of breathing, then that actually is sufficient, which is quite nice to know in a way. So you can deal with that, but of course you have to do it properly, and you have to also use your insight, understanding, the vipassana, and the contemplate the meditation in the right way, and all of that. Because it is more than just watching the breath. You have to overcome the hindrances and all these things. I'll talk about this when I get to it. Basically, if you enjoy Anapanasati, that is sufficient. That is quite nice to know for those of you who enjoy that to do. If you don't really like Anapanasati, then you can probably also do Satipatthana in other ways. By contemplating these dhammas in various ways, the feelings, how they arise, by contemplating the 31 parts of the body, etc. It depends. Okay. Ajahn, can sampajanya be related to sila if it is about awareness of what we are doing? Absolutely, absolutely related to sila, indeed. That is an important point. Because the point of sampajanya is to know whether what you are doing is suitable and whether it is appropriate for what you are doing. So typically, sampajanya is what the monks and the nuns are supposed to have outside of meditation practice. So for example, you have sampajanya when you go into the village to receive alms. Now we don't do that very much these days here, but that is kind of the traditional way. So you have to have clear awareness of whether what you're doing is suitable or not when you go into the village. Here we go into Dhammaloka Center instead, and of course then we have to have a similar kind of sampajanya. Sampajanya, when you talk to people, yeah, am I talking in the appropriate way? Am I talking in a way that leads to better qualities or worse qualities? Am I talking, is it suitable for progress on the path? That's what I should be thinking now, isn't it? That's a good point, because I'm talking away here. When you are listening, same kind of thing, when you're quiet, yeah? So all the activities really outside of meditation, the idea is to think about whether it is suitable or not. And if it is not suitable, it means that often it is a breach of sila, it's a breach of what is appropriate conduct. So absolutely it is related to sila. Sampajanya is one of the things that helps you to kind of stay the course in the right way and to do things that are appropriate and leads you in the right direction. So sila very often can be translated also as habit, yeah, moral habit or character, all these kind of things. And so these things are all related to each other here. Okay, dear Ajahn, you suggested to do death metta contemplation for walking meditation. Can you give an example of how you would actually do it? Okay. So, death meditation while you're doing walking meditation, sometimes all you have to do is to remind yourself that you can die at any time. Yeah, but you really have to feel that in a deep way, that you could die at any time. What does it feel like if I'm going to die before I finish this walking meditation? I mean, if that is too close or too difficult, what does it feel like if I will never leave this retreat center? It is possible, yeah. Maybe you will never leave this retreat center. Maybe this is a good place to die, isn't it? Is that right? Yeah, it's not bad. Yeah, better than dying in the city or dying while you're doing other things, to die right here. So you have to really, if this is a good place to die, well, might as well die here. So then what does it feel like if you're going to die here? It is a real possibility. One day you're going to die, and that day, if you're going to be ready, you have to be ready now. So what does it feel like if you're going to die here? And so you bring that to mind, and you know that, because you know it's going to be one day, and you know that that day is going to be a day just like this, basically, then you have to be ready now, otherwise you're never going to be ready. So what does it feel like then? So you try to feel, I could be dead tomorrow. Yeah, if I'm going to be dead tomorrow, what does that mean right here and now? And what it means right here and now, if you start reflecting on it and you start feeling it, it means that so many of our desires, so many of our attachments start to make no sense anymore. You start to release some of those desires and attachments. Because they are all to do with this world. They're all to do with things you're going to do when you come back home, to do with your life in general. But if you are leaving this world, all of those attachments and desires are empty. They are stupid. They are redundant. You don't need them anymore. And because all your desires are stupid, you actually let them go. It happens automatically because you understand it is silly to have them. And when you let go of your attachments and your desires, what happens is you become peaceful. The reason we're not peaceful, the reason why you are agitated or restless, is usually because of attachments and desires. So this is how you do it. And then you can even specifically remind yourself of ways that you're going to die. Yeah, of ways that, you know, I said before that there are very few snakes here, so it's not dangerous, but there are some snakes. Yeah, occasionally we see snakes, and it is possible that they might bite you. You don't know. This is not to make you fearful, it's just to remind you of the uncertainties of life. But much more likely is that you just walk down the stairs over here, you trip, you fall on your nose, and bang, you're finished. This is much more likely. People die in the strangest ways all the time. Or you walk into the car park, or you walk onto the street or something, and then the drivers are really fast up there. Yeah, suddenly comes a car around the corner. Maybe that Ferrari we were talking about yesterday comes around the corner. Yeah. And then it mows you down, and that's it, finito. And so there are so many ways that we can die. There are so many possibilities. And we just forget how easy this human body is, so fragile, so incredibly fragile. It takes so little to kind of end this life. You may have illnesses in yourself right now that you're not aware of, heart disease, cancer. It doesn't matter how old you are. And very useful sometimes to have family members who have cancer to remind you of your own mortality. I've had a couple of family members who had cancer, and it kind of drives the point home when it gets quite close to you like that. So I often think, well, if my family members have cancer, maybe if I have the same genes, yeah, is there a cancer in here? Maybe. Yeah, don't know. Maybe it's right there, right now. Maybe tomorrow maybe it's already spread through my whole body. I don't know. It's possible. And tomorrow just bang. Actually, if tomorrow might be too quick for cancer to work. But you know what it's like. It can be very close sometimes. You just have no idea. So just to remember these things, how fragile these bodies are, how easily they go wrong, how easily they are injured and injuries and then leading on to death as a consequence. I remember reading in the newspaper a few years ago, there was a man here in Western Australia, he was bitten by a small snake. And he thought, yeah, it's only a small snake, no worries. And half an hour later, he was dead. Yeah, small snakes are just as venomous as the big ones. So if you get bitten by a small snake, don't think it's just a small snake. Go to the doctor straight away. So this is what can happen. So this is how you do the death contemplation. You have to make it real. You really have to feel like you're going to die now. And this can be quite hard because we don't really want to do that. But it also makes it very kind of... if you can do that, it means that you have the ability to let go. And that is actually a very useful thing to be able to do. When eventually you die, you really can let go. You really can know that you're not attached to this world in the same way. Metta contemplation for walking meditation. There's a number of things you can do, but you can do things like, for example, first thing I would always do, and this is how the Buddha teaches the metta in the Kakkachupama Sutta, the simile of the soul, Majjhima Nikaya 21. And you always start off, if you have any irritations or problems with anyone, you start off with that person. You forgive them, you let go, you have metta towards them because you understand they are a human being running on a certain program, their conditions just like everyone else. They want to be happy as well, and they are just stupid and silly. And then you forgive them for whatever fault they may have, and you get that out of the way first of all. This is always the way to start. And then you can just do the metta meditation a little bit like we do here in the hall, but maybe not as profound, depending on how peaceful you get. But just visualize the various directions, visualize all the beings that are out there, maybe the devas and all the good human beings in the world, and just reflect on what a wonderful thing it is that the universe is so full of good beings of various kinds. And see all those beings in your mind's eye, and just feel blessed to be part of that universe and thank them for being there and then wish them well on top of that if you like. And let's see what happens just by bringing that to mind. Metta is the opposite of ill will. Ill will arises when you look at the faults in other people. Metta arises when you see the good qualities in the world around you. So just try that as you do the walking meditation and then see if it gives some results. What would be the difference between contemplation and thinking in this context? They are related to each other. Yeah, it is both contemplation and thinking are movements of the mind. The mind moves a little bit. You direct it in a certain way. And in that sense, they are similar. But you try not to think too much, not to verbalize too much, because all the verbalization often just makes the mind too restless and agitated. So it's more like just bringing up this idea in the mind and then staying with the idea, keeping the idea in mind. Okay, say to yourself, okay, I might die before this, or say to yourself, I might die before the end of this retreat. What would it mean if I did die before the end of this retreat? If I knew I was going to die tomorrow, what does it feel like to know you're going to die tomorrow? And just leave that idea lingering in your mind and see what it feels like. And if it doesn't work, try it again. Try a different angle on it. Remind yourself of what might kill you. And then see if you can make this feeling arise that actually you might really die before the end of this retreat. You are going to die one day, a day probably very much like now. So now is the time to be ready. So just very gently make these suggestions to yourself and then go with the feeling and see what it feels like. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, please recommend some books, some websites and courses for one to thoroughly learn Pali and Sanskrit. Cheapest, okay. thank you so much for this week. Okay, and it's already been the best retreat ever. Wow, that's pretty good. Already the best. Okay, so it can only be downhill from now on. Is that right? No, we'll see how things go. And then at the bottom it says, "Aho sukang, aho sukang." Oh, what happiness! Oh, what happiness! That's Pali for "Oh, what happiness!" Aho sukang, aho sukang. Yeah. So good. Recommend some books and websites and courses for one to thoroughly learn Pali. So, one way to learn Pali is to go to suttacentral.net. Suttacentral.net. This is the website that is run in large part by Bhante Sujato. And if you go there, you find the translations. The translations are on one side of the page and the Pali is on the other side. You can actually see directly how the Pali and the English relate to each other. That is very useful. And if you read the suttas off that page, you can always reference the Pali all the time. And you can see the connection between the Pali and the English, which is can be very useful. There is also, if you want to learn Pali, there is a course book that I have usually used to teach Pali. When I used to teach Pali, I've now handed it over to one of the other monks at the monastery, because teaching Pali is an incredibly privilege. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to be able to teach others, because you learn so much by teaching others. So I felt I had to hand it on to someone else, because I had already learned quite a lot through teaching others. And the course book that I used to use, and I think he has also used in the new one, is a book by a fellow called A.K. Warder. A.K. Warder, Warder, W-A-R-D-E-R. And it's called Introduction to Pali. And the course that I did on that book is actually available on the internet. You can listen to all of those lessons that we did, and they are available on a website called Wisdom and Wonders. This website has all kinds of teaching by Ajahn Brahm and myself, and I think Ajahn Sujato as well, and certainly the Pali lessons are to be found on there. So you can go there and you can listen to the Pali lessons there if you want to have a bit more explanation of how it works. It's called Wisdom and Wonders is the name of the website. That is how you learn Pali. Sanskrit. Very often, if you learn Pali well, you will be able to read quite a bit of Sanskrit too, but Sanskrit is much more difficult to learn than Pali, so I would really put an effort in Pali first of all, and then if you want to carry on with Sanskrit later on, you can do that later on. But really, if you're interested in Buddhism, you can go a long, long way with Pali, and Sanskrit really isn't all that important. Better to learn something like ancient Chinese. Yeah, if you want to learn ancient Chinese, that's really cool. You can read as many more suttas in ancient Chinese than there is in Sanskrit. So then you can kind of read them in that. But of course, that takes a lot of time to learn ancient Chinese and Pali and Sanskrit and maybe Tibetan as well. There are people who know all of these languages. Isn't that kind of astonishing? Yeah, some of the monks that I know, they actually know Pali, Sanskrit, ancient Chinese, Tibetan, English, German, Russian, Italian, French, Spanish, and probably more beside. They don't know Norwegian, by the way. That's really bad. They should learn Norwegian. Norwegian, very useful language to know Norwegian. So that is what I would recommend. And so start with that. And if you are having troubles, then let me know, and maybe I can guide you in some other direction there. But Sutta Central is a very useful website. One of the nice things about Sutta Central is, for example, there is a lookup dictionary there, so you can hover over an English word. You can hover over the Pali words rather, and it will give you the English translation of that specific Pali word. It has a lot of really nice things going on the suttacentral.net. So try it out. It's a very good tool for learning languages and all of these kind of things. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in some instances the suttas say to forget the past, not to think about it. But in some instances it says think about the past good karma. and enjoy it. But past is past, good or bad. How can the two be how do the two fit together? Sort of what you're trying to say. Please explain. Thank you. Okay. The answer is that, yes, sometimes it is good to think about the past. The point is that a lot of the time we think about the past, it is not because we want to think about the past, but because the mind goes there whether we want to or not. It is like a habit, yeah? But if you deliberately go to the past and you're just doing it because for a certain particular purpose, it's a very different way of going into the past. So what you want to avoid is all this problem when the mind just goes there because of habit, because of conditioning, because of defilements, because of all of these kind of things. It basically, the mind is out of control. That is what you want to avoid. That kind of past thinking is useless. But if it is under your control, you decide, I'm going to look into the past for a specific purpose, then it is perfectly okay. It's exactly the same thing about thinking about the future. If it is just the mind randomly going into the future because of habits or whatever, then it's no good. But sometimes you need to plan, for example. Yeah, you need to plan even just to get here to Jhana Grove. You need to plan a little bit. What should I bring? Oh, can I need this, I need that. That's okay, because you are it's a specific task that you're looking into, and you are deliberately thinking about the future. But if it is just the mind habitually going there, that is when it is a problem. So it is about whether you are in charge or not, whether you feel in control or not of your mind. That is really the issue. So if you sit down and you meditate and your mind does all of these things automatically, you're not really in charge. But if you decide, okay, I'm going to do this, and then you do it, then you have a sense of control. The difference is whether you have real mindfulness or not. That is the difference. If you have real mindfulness, then you can make good use of thinking about the past, as in recalling your good past, good karma, and these kind of things. Yeah, as the mindfulness starts to rise, you get clarity in the mind, and you want to get a bit of joy, that is when you kind of do this little nudge in the mind. You ask your mind, what is a nice thing I did in the past that felt really good at that time? You bring that to mind, you bring that feeling into the present moment, the joy arises, and then it takes you deeper into meditation as a consequence. Okay, last question for tonight. Dear Bhante, can you please teach metta meditation as taught by the Buddha in the suttas? If possible, read a guided metta meditation sermon. Also, which suttas should I read to understand metta meditation better? Okay, we can do a guided metta meditation that is more based on the suttas. What I would recommend you to read, one of the great suttas about metta meditation, is the Simile of the Saw, Middle Length Sayings of the Buddha number 21. It is really all about metta meditation. That is a good one. Of course, you have the Karaniya Metta Sutta found in the Sutta Nipata, in the Kuddhaka Nikaya, the small collection of discourses. It's a very nice one. It gives some beautiful ideas how to practice metta, such as the mother looking after her only child. In the same way, you look at all beings in the world. That's kind of nice, isn't it? You are the mother of all beings in the world. Every being, you look at them as if they are your only child. It's a beautiful way of thinking about other people. And of course, the Buddha says that we have been in this kind of relationship with everyone in the world. Everyone has been our child. Yeah, everyone has been our parent. Everyone has been our brother, sister, husband, wife, all of these relationships, pretty much everyone anyway, because of the length of our journey through samsaric existence. So because everyone has been there in that relationship with you, it should be possible to view other people as your child. How do you feel about your child if you are a mother? Well, you are very forgiving. You have endless patience with the child. You're always able to see the good qualities there because you have seen the child growing up being small and sweet and having all those beautiful qualities. You remember that. You know that those qualities are in there and you're able to focus on that. So it's a very useful perception to use, the idea of being the mother of an only child. And I think all of us have an ability to think what that actually means to a large extent. So Metta Sutta, Kakkacchupamma Sutta, Simile of the Saw, You have also some suttas I call the Metta-Nisangsa Sutta, the benefits of metta. They're found in the Anguttara 10s and 11s. I can't remember the number now. What number is it? And I think the Anguttara 11's number 11 or 14 or something like that. It's in there, the benefits of metta. It just gives you the benefits of metta practice. But the way that metta is usually explained in the suttas, it is not explained in any great deal. It is just said that you have metta to the four directions, and that is found in places like, for example, in the simile of the cloth, Majjhima Nikaya number 7, you find the method, that standard method for how metta is spread around the world. Another useful sutta is the Kosambiya Sutta, Majjhima Middle-length Sang number 48, is a very nice one, because that sutta shows that metta is not just about spreading metta to the whole world and doing it as a meditation practice, but metta actually starts with how we treat people by body, speech and mind. It starts with treating each other with kindness. Yeah, that's where it starts with. And this is a very important thing to remember, rather than trying to kind of do metta meditation from scratch and not really applying it in our daily life. It should really be the other way around. Apply it in your daily life. Have metta to people around you as much as you possibly can. Treat them with kindness, yeah? And speak to them with kindness. Think about people with kindness. In private, in public, whatever situation you are in, especially the people who are closest to you, because they are often the most difficult to have metta towards, because our actions with them are often so habitual. And that is where it starts, and this is where what Majjhima Nikaya 48 talks about. So there you are, that's quite a few suttas for you already, and see if that is helpful. Yes, let us try. Let's do a guided metta meditation as well, and see what happens with that. Okay, that is all for tonight. So please have a nice rest, have a good night's sleep, and we'll see you again tomorrow morning here.